Welcome, listeners. You've tuned into Whiskey and Widgets, the one-stop podcast where technology meets the tantalizing world of whiskey. Whether you're a tech enthusiast, keen on the latest breakthroughs, or a whiskey connoisseur with a palate for fine distillates, you're in the right place. So pull up a chair, pour yourself a glass of your favorite spirit. Let's boot up another enriching episode of Whiskey and Widgets. I'm your co-host, Chris.
And I'm your co-host, James. Thank you again for joining us on our Whiskey and Widgets journey, where we explore topics that matter and widgets we're passionate about, all over a drink. This week, Chris, I don't know about you, but it's been that sort of a last couple of weeks. So I'm busting out some scotch, pouring it over a whiskey steel, and we're just calling it a day.
You know, you just have to celebrate that you got through the day, and there's another day. There's tomorrow, and I'm okay with that. You know, you do what you can in a day that you got, and move on, put things aside, prioritize, and move on to the next day, and pick up where you left off. And just disconnect. Like, today is perfect, right? Like, everybody, I'm sure all the listeners here, we all have to go through some crazy days, crazy weeks, but hey, you know, it's not the end of the world.
What are you drinking this week, Chris?
Okay. So I appreciate you asking me that, James. I haven't drank this brand in a long time, but it made it a few times on top 10 lists or top 10 whiskeys of the years. And I am drinking a special limited release from Woodinville. It is a straight bourbon whiskey finished in port cask. This is really good. It's probably one of my favorite whiskey around.
This is your first time and trying it, or have you tried it before?
I've tried it before. I've gotten, you know, a couple bottles in the past, and I realized, you know, it's been a while since I drank one of these, and I happened to pick this up a couple weeks ago. I just never opened it, and I saw it. I was coming down here preparing for this podcast, and I saw it. I was like, you know what? This looks good. Going back to my favorites and just enjoying a nice afternoon of a warm whiskey with you, James. Well, I'm not warm. Room temperature. Room temperature. Straight. But yeah. How about you, James? What are you drinking today?
You know, I don't actually remember what it is. I decanted this. It's a scotch that I decanted into my whiskey decanter, and it's been sitting on my table for, I think, since January. I don't remember what I poured in it. So we're going to drink a bunch and see if I can figure out what it is by the time I'm done drinking it.
So when you put them in a decanter, do you have a decanter for each type of whiskey, or do you wash it and then mix it or something like that? I don't know.
Yeah. So I have a different decanter that I use for each of my primary spirits. And to help everyone with that, I have little copper plates that tell you what style of spirit it is. The dilemma is I know offhand what my typical what I refer to as house whiskey is for different things, right? But I don't remember what I selected as my house whiskey for my scotch. So it could be monkey shoulder. I don't know. As a bit of a joke reference, bars obviously have their house liquors, and they're typically super rail. On my end, I use the joke of a house liquor as that's just what I'm actively drinking. So when friends come over and they want something, I'm like, all right, well, which one do you want? I got my house liquors out there. So oftentimes my house gin is Botanist. That's not a cheap gin.
Wow. Do you do that? Do you have if I sure do it, if that I have guests coming over and, if someone wants have whiskey, I just kind of like, hey, whatever is on my decanter, which is something that I don't just, you know what I mean? Like, it's just kind of a
so all of
normal one to go to, not open expensive
all
ones.
All of my decanted stuff is quality things that anybody would enjoy if they like that spirit, but not necessarily extra premium. So,
I see what you're saying.
Like, for example, if I was to use Whistle Pig as my rye in my decanter, I'd probably do the Piggyback, which is a 6-year. Mm-hmm. That's a fine whiskey. It's not even a cheap whiskey, but it's also not a $200 bottle.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's still whiskey that you drink, and there's still good whiskeys, but you don't put your like premium
whiskeys. I have effectively like three layers of whiskey that I do, or well, liquor spirits at my house. I have a actual top shelf, which I originally like. I was fundamentally opposed to this idea of having top shelf. I wanted to make sure that if I have a thing, regardless of quality, I want to share it with other people that'll appreciate it. And then I had a good friend of mine who knows nothing about liquor decide they were going to make a cocktail, and they made just the grossest cocktail out of three very expensive liquors. And I'm like, that cocktail, that one glass at a bar would probably be like an $80 cocktail.
Oh man.
And I'm just like, and it tastes bad because of what you did to it. So I was like, all right, you know what?
Yes.
I want to let people playground, but lesson learned, if I have a bottle that's like 200 plus, I'm going to put it in a separate space to make it obvious to someone that doesn't know.
Ouch. That would be painful if you were to do that.
The unfortunate thing is just like, he didn't know. I can't judge him for it. And it was just unfortunate because there was a bunch of things that were very good individual sipping things.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it is what it is. So I started doing that. I split those out to a top shelf. I have a big section that has all my liquor in it that's in the bottle, so you know what it is. And then I keep on the top of my liquor built in, I have my decanted liquors. Yeah. For anybody that's curious, I'll throw on Instagram today a photo of what I'm drinking so you can see my scotch and my glass. But yeah, it's good times.
Which reminds me, so I've posted some stuff in there, as well as, you know, I think beer, you know, at that time. So if you are listening to this, your first time listener, or maybe the second or third episode you're listening, we do have an Instagram that you can follow, and you can check out what James, myself, and Brad drinks. And you can check it out. You can interact with us there. You can make comments. You can make suggestions of whiskeys that we should try, because, you know, sometimes it's like limited what's available in our areas. But yeah, we want to check it out. And maybe cocktails that goes well with some of the whiskeys that we present. But check us out there.
I will say I do enjoy a good straight liquor on occasion, like tonight. But I tend to be much more of a cocktail person, and it's fun to explore, experiment with that, and kind of share that. As a note, Chris, I'm looking forward to when we do our in-person episode next, doing some New York sours with you.
I would love that, man. I would give it a shot with some sours. I haven't really drank some much sours.
Do you know what a New York sour is?
Yeah. No, please tell us. What is it?
So a New York sour is fascinating because it's effectively just a regular sour, typically served up, but you float a dry red wine on top of it.
Oh, okay. Is there specific red wine that you put
there on top? There are some specific red wines that go really, really well that way. I don't want to do any spoilers. Okay. There's some restaurants in the area that make really good cocktails. I'm going to show those to you, and we'll explore that when you come visit. A fun part of all of this, to anyone that's new on the listening journey, for us, it's all about exploration. We, Chris and I, like to explore what's good for food, what's good for drink, and go through that experience. And sometimes we find our tastes change. So here's a question for you, Chris. What scotch has an incredibly small, strong maple on the nose? What scotch would I have bought that has just a really strong maple nose? The scotch.
I have no clue because I don't drink enough scotch.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to solve this mystery. This is a weird one.
Is that what it tastes right now? Yeah. What you're drinking? You're trying to figure out what kind of scotch it is?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what bottle I poured into this decanter because I did it so long ago and I haven't done scotch for a while.
It's so funny, dude.
It has a little bit of that like tart sourness that you can get from a scotch. Like the peat is like way in the background. Huge amounts of maple on the nose. It's smooth. I'll add some water to it in a bit and we'll figure that out. So, exciting things. It's been a journey this week. Like, just so many different things happening, both in the news as well as just work stuff happening all around. But I wanted to talk to you about a really cool product that I've been looking for a long time that just announced that they have pre-orders for it, and it's already sold out. So,
what is it? Exciting. I'm excited.
It's the Framework laptop, 16-inch model.
Oh, I saw an article about that. So tell me a little bit about that, because I am curious how this all works out. Because I remember, did you mention another one a while ago? Is it the same one?
Yeah. So this is the you can build it yourself updated one, right? Framework laptop, but the 16-inch model is an updated model. It's a larger screen, and because it's a larger framework or framework laptops, larger frame, because of this larger form factor, they have an option now for discrete graphics, which they never had before. And that is really enticing. So now you can get a framework and you can swap out parts over time. And if you want to upgrade, you can disassemble it, swap out the motherboard with the CPU, put in the new chipset. Now you're upgraded and you can just keep doing that over time.
You know what's crazy is that, so for those who are, you know, not into laptops, your gaming desktops, whatever. And so I think the laptop space for gaming has come a long way. And there's a few things I want to bring up around this gaming laptop. But I love where they're going with portables. And just FYI, they're very competitive in pricing too. So it's not like a long shot to have a customizable machine unique for what your needs are and still be able to pay as if you were to buy like the name brand, the big ones with the same, maybe the same specs and capability. But this is amazing, man. I see that they have the pre-order. Frame.work is the website, correct?
It's frame.work. And that's your Framework laptop. And we're not sponsored by them, but I'm very excited about it because I was a PC enthusiast. I promise you it wasn't cool when I first started being a PC enthusiast. And digging through and trying to build your own machine and really push the limits on it, building out a laptop was a challenging thing. Very few options that could exist for it. And it always feels wasteful to me when you're like, I want to upgrade this component, but like now I just got to go buy a whole new laptop. And they've released a design that's intended to be very modular and designed in a way where it's supposed to be able to keep up with potential future cooling needs. That's cool. Overall aesthetic
and it's portable.
Yeah,
and it's portable because like people could argue and say, well, you can get one of those external graphics card enclosure. But that kind of defeats the purpose. You have to plug it in and all that stuff. So might as well get a desktop. And it's expensive. But if you're traveling for work and you're in the airport or airplane, it'll be just nice to pull up a laptop and play a full-on game. And of course, Wi-Fi is now available, right? In some of your flights out there. So it's perfect, man. You can play your Fortnite game.
The idea that you can get a 16-inch machine and you can like just decide you want to rearrange it and be like, listen, I want a 10 key. Anybody that doesn't know what a 10 key is, that's the number pad on the side. So you decide you want a 10 key. Sweet. You can add a 10 key. Later, you're like, you know what? I don't love the positioning on this. I want to replace it. You can take the 10 key off. You can center your keyboard and then put spacers on the sides. And it's the same laptop. You just rearrange your components. They've designed the whole thing to just be, you can rearrange it, strip awesome. It down, rebuild it. That's neat. So yeah, I love what they're doing, the idea behind what they're doing. The first version of it that they're releasing is an AMD solution. So it's going to have AMD Ryzen and AMD Radeon RX GPU, if you want to go with a dedicated GPU. But there's another thing too, right? So Chris, let's say you wanted to do a framework and you put in a dedicated GPU like that. You just slide the whole thing off the back. So if you decided you're traveling and you didn't want that extra weight, you can slide in a replacement that weighs less for your integrated. So, you know, you're not powering up games. You just need it for office products at the time, maybe. Easy swaps.
That is super easy. You know, one thing I don't understand, and maybe NVIDIA and AMD may come together and standardizing some of these things. If you standardize a size of a graphical chip or a graphics card in a way that manufacturers can build enclosures on their laptops, and that way people can just quickly swap it out. Maybe they want to upgrade to, I don't know, RTX 5080 or whatever the next number comes out. They sell that chip. All they got to do is put it on their new enclosure. The standard connector is still there. And boom, you get an upgraded chip or graphics card on your laptop. And of course, you'd have to determine the power consumption. But, you know, manufacturers can easily replace the power supply on those laptops as well.
Yeah.
So I think something to consider with the way things are going. We're all portable. Do people still build desktops?
Yeah,
it got real
weird during the pandemic. It got real, real weird because
super expensive. Well,
there were certain parts that were very desirable by enthusiasts. They effectively became unavailable, and it got to a place where some of those parts, the easiest way to get it was to buy a pre-built that had it, because you couldn't source it as a consumer.
And then strip it out and then put it on your machine?
There were definitely some people that were doing that. If you check out the threads that are all about thrifty acquisition of parts. But it's a kind of a weird thing.
In the Bitcoin space too, right? Like the Bitcoin didn't help because then the graphics card got super expensive and they were being bought out in bulk. And so people like you and I are PC enthusiasts. It got really expensive because you're buying off market for those.
Something else that I love about what Framework is doing there, it's not just Windows. They support Linux distributions right out of it. Like, go for it, use Linux.
Nice.
And they even have a model that's specifically for Chromebook. So you can build out and manage your own Chromebook stuff. So I appreciate
that's cool.
The ideals behind what caused them to create this. Is it going to put Dell out of business? No, probably not. But it's super cool.
That is super cool. I do have a question for you, James. You know, is this something that can be used, or would it? Could you use it in an enterprise level? Would this be something that an enterprise business would consider versus
they just, do have options for you to do a professional version of Windows. So that's an option. As it relates to whether or not an enterprise would want to deploy Framework as like their standard model and they just swap out parts based off what the user needs, I think that's a pretty viable thing in the right business. You have to have the interest and the capacity to be able to manage the hardware. But if your business that's already managing that hardware and you're like keeping spares, now instead of keeping spares, you're keeping spare parts.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be really cool if you could do that.
If somebody's machine dies, like you could swap out all the parts for them very quickly. You don't even need a replacement chassis. Like you could still keep spares, but yeah, I think it's a fantastic overall build. For anybody that's curious, you know, standard price point, you go look at it. It starts at about $1,300 for the DIY Framework 16-inch machine. And you can build it out to be, you know, $3,000+ if you put every bell and whistle into it.
That's no different than you buying like maxed out some of those brands, right? I know like Razer as a gaming laptop. I own one of those, by the way, which is I'm not proud of spending that much money on a gaming laptop. But they can't, you know, those things go up to like $3,000, $4,000. And so I think this is a viable option, man, for people to consider. If you are a gamer and want a laptop and be able to control what you want, check it out. Frame.work. By the way, nothing against Razer. I love my Razer laptop. I still have but I don't.
You heard it here. Chris doesn't like Razer.
I did. Okay. Razer, when I first bought my Razer laptop, it died on me in a week. So they had a lot of QA issues. And where I was lucky, do you remember Microsoft Store? Mm-hmm. Anybody remember Microsoft Store? There's very few of them in the world, but we had several Microsoft Store because, of course, I'm in Washington State. They had an amazing insurance plan or whatever you call them, a service plan, where I think it was like $100 for like 2 years or something like that. I can't remember that many years, but they will swap it out for you with no questions asked. So there was two laptops that I bought from Microsoft Store, which, by the way, I wish they come back. They've been defunct. That store's gone. But I remember buying an Alienware at Microsoft Store, and it had issues, heating issues. It was warm. I returned it, and they were like, okay, I think I returned like 3 months. And way outside the return policy. And like, well, did you get the service plan? It's like, yeah, I did. And it's like, okay, perfect. We'll just do a return. What would you like? And I was like, okay, well, let me get a Razer. It was the same price at that time. And I ordered it. I bought it and all the stuff. And they transferred the service plan to the Razer. A week later, my Razer died. QA problem. I went through two of those. And every time they just replaced it with the new one. And the second one, when the Razer failed on me, I think it was like 7 months or 8 months in, it died on me. Came back to Microsoft, said, hey, I got the service plan. I've had it for 7 months. And I was like, great, just pick out the next one. And they were like, okay, do I spend the same dollar amount or the value of it is now? And they're like, nope, same dollar that you bought. Got the newest one. And they took care of me. And I was like, okay, well, just, you know, just buy the new service plan for it. And I still have that Razer, and I love it. And actually, my youngest son uses it now to play Roblox. But this is like a four-year-old Razer machine, and it still kicks butt. I think it's an RTX 2070 Q, MQ, or whatever that version is. It still kicks butt, man. He still plays like high-end gaming, and it still works
so
well.
So what I think I just heard was an endorsement of their QA is bad, but the service plan was awesome.
The service plan that Microsoft provided was awesome. I wish they came back, man. It's just too bad that they closed their store. I really don't know the reason why they closed the store, but it was so cool to come in there. Because everyone knows what the Apple store looks like, right? It's just pretty simple, pretty laid back. But if you look at a Microsoft store, we love going there because there was like, you can try out all the gaming PCs, all the amazing keyboards, and an area for you to like play Xbox, you know, it in a teaching class. It was so cool. And it was like Microsoft backed store, and you get to try new things that Microsoft is working on. And of course it went away. I think after COVID, it just closed their Microsoft store. I wish they'd bring it back because it was really cool to see what Microsoft is working on. I think they even had HoloLens at one of their stores for you to try out, which is like amazing. But
the last,
it died.
The last Microsoft store that I went to was in New York, and it was a super cool store. I had a conference that was hosted there. It was pretty sweet. I guess I'll just say to everyone, thank you for joining us through that, and learn and know, like grow, test, try, like experiment with things. And I would encourage you, you know, if you're the sort of person that's looking for a laptop and it meets your spec requirements, go check out Framework. See if it fits your need.
Check it out.
So this brings into another conversation that's interesting to me. We have been doing just a ton of stuff looking at what's going on with AI. Chris, did you see the most recent announcements from Microsoft from Inspire in the last few weeks?
Yeah, that was amazing, man. Like they shared a lot, but I would love to hear what you took away from that. Like what's one thing that you're excited about?
So I'm excited about a lot of things, but I'm going to put a pin in all of the ones that are like corporate business related, because I want to make sure anybody listening can pick up on this. So many people, even outside of their job, use Office. So here's I've got a question for you, Chris. Do you think Copilot for Office is good enough or worth it for a home user to pay for?
For a home user?
Yeah.
I see. What does an average home user use their Windows machine for? Now, if you use any of the Office products, whether you do PowerPoint presentation for school or whatever, did they give pricing? Is there a price for those?
They do. It's super expensive. Copilot is. The home office licenses are pretty affordable. Copilot is $30 per person right now, per month.
Okay. So that's hard. We have to like figure out what a typical home user, is it worth it either for personal use and for work? Work is given, right? For work, I would use it, right? I would use it. It's done a wonderful job. Again, it's just any other tool. Brad is not here, but if he was to say it, he would say it like this. AI is a tool. Blah, 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 blah.
That is exactly.
Yes, it is.
He would come in here and he would say, AI is a tool that everyone should use.
And it's just that. No, dude, I would use it as a typical home use. I don't think it's worth it. Now, if you bring in like a family member that uses it like for school, I couldn't remember
what it was, so I had to quick Google it. Microsoft 365 family plan, if you want like the Office suite for a year, supports 6 people. It's $100 a year. So that means if you wanted to use Copilot, assuming they have an option for personal, I don't actually know that they would.
$100 a year? That's not bad, dude.
But it's $360 a year for Copilot for one person.
Wait, if you spend the $100 a year for the family plan, it comes with Copilot, or you have to pay for Copilot separately? $360 per year, $30 a month.
Yeah.
Ooh. Okay. It depends what you're trying to do. So if it's grammar stuff in Word, I would use Grammarly at that point. Like, I'm not paying an AI Copilot.
Well, so, all right, here's a question. Think about it this way. People that are like, you know, novice authors or people that write fanfic, a lot of them write it in Word before they try to go get it published. And you could ask Copilot to help you write like whole sections of your story. You could write out a bunch of things and be like, I need a scene to fill this in. Can you give me a scene in conjunction with what I already have here? And it could collaboratively write for you.
Yeah, that's my point, right? Like, it really depends of how you would use it. Because at that point, that's kind of like your project. That's kind of work related. Yes, it would be very useful for those situations. So
a fun tangent, right? All right, but first, before I tangent, actually, I don't think I see a lot of home users wanting to pay that. I don't think they'll see the value in it. It's a lot of money. But let's talk about that author thing for a second. If you write a story and you use any AI, let alone Copilot, what do you think? Is that still your story? When you go to publish it, like, do you need to disclose that you use that tooling? Is there a moral obligation to let people know that a machine helped you come up with the prose you used?
Yeah, but it has, I think it's still yours to some degree, because it still comes from your imagination. You still have to describe what you're trying to write. And sometimes you have a writer's block, which is a common thing. There's times where, like, dude, I have email blocks. I don't know how to articulate this. And so I use AI, like, how would I articulate this? And so those are very, very important to consider when you are utilizing AI, because it does use your data. It does use information that you give. There are tools out there that are using public information, stuff like that. But even at that point, I mentioned about Grammarly, because I use Grammarly day to day to, you know, check my grammar. And what's really cool is that my understanding, Grammarly has started to use AI-powered writing assistant. So, you know, I don't know what the price for that is. So if that is your profession and you are a book writer, you can pay for a service directly from Grammarly versus utilizing Microsoft's Copilot. Now, I do see that there's going to be vying for your wallet, whether you stick with Grammarly to help you with your AI, help you with the story writing or context or content, or since you're already using Microsoft Word, just use their Copilot and it'll do the same thing.
So Chris, let's say, what if we made a whole episode of our podcast where instead of us just talking and sharing what we think, we read the script and it was an AI generated script. What do you think? And frankly, anybody listening would love to get feedback. Like, would you be interested in this? Does that change the value of what's being shared? Assuming you thought there was value to begin with. Like, as we're talking through stuff, an AI is not going to be able to drink with us, but I mean, a lot of the other topics.
Well, you can have a trigger and say, hey AI, I want you to be someone who just drank two glasses of whiskey.
Yeah, but is that the same? Like, is AI going to be able to interpret like how it would change someone's personality, or like I bet it could imitate a number of things, but it's also not going to be able to talk about or articulate this random whiskey that's got maple on the nose. Why does this smell like maple, Chris?
I get that, but you can also feed it to the fact, like, hey, you know, this is a Woodinville straight bourbon whiskey and it's made this way, it's this year, it's this, has flavoring. I want you to write me something that expresses the taste of this whiskey. I'm sure I'll put something together. And it could be as truthful as me saying it. I don't know, man. It's starting to be really tough because, look, Brad's not here, but he worked on something that I thought was very fascinating where he took, I think we talked about this in our podcast, where there was a podcast between Joe Rogan and Steve Jobs interviewing each other. Yeah. And so,
hey, don't spoilers on the thing that Brad's working on.
I won't give any spoilers. I would love to give it, but we could do, you could do that now. We can have an entire thing, not only written by an AI, but being read on voice. And so, is it us? Is it still us?
The whole conversation around deepfakes is still deeply disturbing to me. Deepfakes. The idea that artificial intelligence can represent or present someone else while it's not actually them, it's kind of a concern.
Dude, I got to tell you, talking about learning your voice. So do you know on Apple's iOS 17, which is right now is on beta, that they are releasing what they consider this as accessibility add-on, and that you can, what it does is that you record yourself, and you can get to this if you're beta testing iOS 17, you can get through this via settings and accessibility. And what it has you do is read a few paragraphs with your voice, and it will take your voice, and anytime that you type something, it can read it back to you with your own voice. So can you imagine now it's going to be on your handheld?
Have you ever heard of Dragon naturally speaking?
Yes. Yes.
So I've helped a few businesses operate with it that needed it. And actually, quick shout out in the Milwaukee area. There's a nonprofit in the Milwaukee area that I think is pretty wonderful called Vision Forward. I worked with them for a short period of time. They help do a lot of things to assist people with vision impairment. They also do a lot in the community to help bring awareness to what it's like to be someone with vision impairments, to make sure that a society at large can help accommodate that particular group of people. And I think that's important. Naturally speaking is a really interesting aid as it relates to how we work with technology. And my dad, actually, before he passed, I helped him use Dragon naturally speaking to record out all of the stories and memories he had in his head so he could get them out of his head as he was starting to lose his memories and Alzheimer's was happening to him. He wanted to make sure he could share it and that those could be available for people in the future. And so he'd just talk to the computer and record them out. And then he'd print them and he'd send them as letters to all of his children and grandchildren. That is a powerful use of technology. And I think that that AI element is interesting. Can you imagine step?
That's amazing.
If we could then have my dad's voice reading those stories back?
Exactly. Isn't that amazing?
That's the positive side of AI, where you can use it for malicious intent and for evil. Yes. Same with many things. But consider that idea that someone could write you a letter and you could have AI read it back in their voice.
That is so amazing. And again, this is kind of like we all say in this episode, is you have this cool, amazing technology, and it really depends on whether you use it for the good or for the bad. So the idea of iOS 17 releasing, it falls under the accessibility component. So what this is called assistive access. It's a new feature within iOS 17, which adds a customizable interface to make the iPhone easier to use for people with cognitive disabilities. So live speech offers up a way for people that can't speak to have their words spoken in person or on the phone and use or create a voice that's similar to theirs. So it's easier for them to relay information that the phone can do for them by just typing it up. So for example, I can be on a drive-thru and, you know, and I want, and, you know, I lost my voice or something like that. And I want to be able to order something. Instead of me writing things down, I can type it up and then, you know, play it back and boom, that's my voice. It sounds like me or it could sound like you or not you. Close enough that it can relay the information that you're trying to say. So
I think
it's fascinating, man. Things are changing so fast.
I think there's some really powerful applications to this sort of thing. Now, a call out on the accessibility side of it, reading back in your own voice. I think personally, I would hate that. I hate the sound of my own voice. I'm glad that our listeners like to listen to me talk because I don't like listening to me talk. But to
your use though, like I want to be able, like, if anybody can leave a copy of their voice so that in the future you can hear your grandfather's voice and your grandma's voice. I think that's amazing.
Do you think there's materially better or different value in an AI being able to reproduce your voice to say new things as opposed to just a recording of whatever last sentiment somebody might give?
That's an interesting, this is like sci-fi realm, right? Because I remember there was a show or commercial or something that I can't remember, and where you can go to a cemetery and be able to have a voice that that sounds like your, you know, someone, you know, a family member or friend or whatever, speak back to you, and then just have AI think of what they would say to you because you fed it, you know, a terabyte of data of voice and content about somebody or, you know, of that person. I think that's fascinating. I think it helps with grief.
Yeah.
In my opinion. Well,
maybe, but it might also go the other direction. It might make it harder for somebody to let go because it's almost like they're still there. And now you can have that feeling of a shallowness of what's left, and you've got that. So one of the concerns that I spent a lot of time talking to my dad about as he was getting sick and before he passed was this idea that he felt like he was losing himself and he was becoming more hollow, and he didn't want that. And he didn't want to be remembered as the hollow version of him. He wanted to be remembered as the full and vibrant version of him. So it's an interesting thing. But like at the same time, thinking about it in the other direction, like the positivity, the potential of like the optimal done correct, right? What if there was a critical mass of things you could do to train the AI? You can let it hear you. You can select ideologies and things to make sure that it stays within a framework of what you actually believe. And what if that existed? And now all of a sudden, it's not you. It's not that sci-fi version of downloading your brain, but it's an AI that's pretending to be you. I mean, is that cool? Is it heartwarming? Is it creepy? Y'all have to let us know.
Yeah, it really depends, man. It really depends how you handle loss and grief. And it's really, that's deep, right? That's really deep, because how cool would it be, going back to my experience, I got to know my grandfather, but I didn't get to know his story about fighting in World War II. And I would love to hear it. Here's the thing. He wrote it down. He wrote down his experience throughout his life. And, you know, it's a common thing for people to journal in his age, at least his generation, to journal things that he did on a daily basis. And he had shared some of those writings on his time as a in the military. So how cool would it be if I was to feed that data in his voice and tell his story that he had written in his own voice. That would be so fascinating. I mean,
that is an interesting documentary, frankly. Like, that's, especially if you were to take something like that and you were able to capture the inflection and the mood of the person, if as you were able to go back through it, you're able to, you know, that person didn't voice act their life, right? They lived it. They recorded their experience. And if AI could get to a place where it's not just voice interpretation or imitation, but there could be that layer of cognitive implication to inform that voice interpretation, to be able to say, hey, with this information, knowing the age of the person and what they're doing, when they write this, they're saying it with sarcasm.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah. But I get your point too. Like, there's a part of that where, when do you let go? Or it would prevent people from letting go. And so they're kind of stuck within that world of like, I want to hear their voice one more time.
Well, what about that scenario? You never got to say goodbye. What if you had a limited AI service that would imitate that person's voice and it would just be enough for them to say goodbye and give you an opportunity to feel that closure? Is that a benefit?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, for somebody listening, is that a service you're going to go create?
Yeah, that's a interesting balance. And I think we're getting there as a society of like, how far do you go with AI? And that's tough, man. I get what you're saying too. I see both sides of being able to like, hey, you got to move on with your life. But at the same time, some people have grief that like, I want to hear their voice every day. You know, I want to be able to speak to them and have a conversation. Yeah, they're not there physically. Human beings, you want that physical touch, right? Like, we're all designed that way. I want to be hugged and, you know, touch, hold hands and things like that. You'll never get that, right? But hearing their voice and bringing those memories back and having a conversation is no different than what we're doing now. We're doing now via technology, via
telecommunications,
Zoom, Teams, right? So we do that right now. Like, I mean, it's funny because I speak to family members that are not even near me over the phone more than people that are maybe closer to me. But if you lost someone at some point in your life, it's like having a conversation over the phone. How's your day been? You know, oh man, that's tough, dude.
And here's another great example. I lost my sister a long time ago. She was an amazing person. And one of the things that was like a hallmark of her personality is she had some of the best wit and snark. She was a funny person. I'm not a hugely funny person. I'm not the best at comedy. She was amazing at comedy. Like, her timing and what she would do at the most choice moments, right? There's a family dinner happening and someone's getting really long-winded and she's just been, you know, eating her potatoes. And then all of a sudden she just goes, and she's just like, okay, cool. We're your Snoopy teacher situation. Like, come on, let's move on. Like, placement matters. And
yes,
sometimes the concern I would have with an application like that is to distill a person down to a gimmick or to like a component that was like you don't want a memory of somebody to become a punchline. At the same time, though, you know, a lot of your memory of somebody is that combination, that collection of their punchlines, their references, not even necessarily mm-hmm. in just a funny sense. So, yeah, it's a fascinating thing. Like, what do you suppose it's like for the family of Steve Jobs to hear that interview? Joe Rogan interviewing Steve Jobs.
That's a good question. I can't put myself in their shoes, you know, hearing that, but here's the thing. We did this exercise about hearing your own voice, and it doesn't people will know it doesn't sound like you. It may be very close. It may be, the way he said that or she said that, oh, it does sound like him. But you lose that characteristics of like something very unique in the way you speak that an AI would probably never replicate. I don't know, man.
Is that just a matter of, you know, progression? Like, is it the same as, think of the resolution we had on video 20 years ago versus today? Like, progression of AI, is that clarity and accuracy something that would improve over time? What we have today, could we consider our current implementations of it the same as, say, as an example, a tube monitor? And now, what's it look like when you're liquid crystal display? What's it look like when you're moving beyond that? And maybe AI, as it develops, it gets better. The thing that is a concern for me, and I encourage people to contemplate and share, because as a society, we have to address this. It's not just a matter of can the technology, it's should it. And if it should, are there frameworks, are there guidelines for, if it's done in the spirit of accessibility, that's great.
Mm.
But is that accessibility, if done incorrectly, now damaging? And how do you balance that?
I will say, James, as history says, us humans have never been a proactive to technology. We've always been kind of a reactive, in terms of guidelines and policy, always. By the way, just to be clear. We've always been a reactive. There's never been a time in human history when it comes to technology where, unless someone proves me, where we're proactive of something that becomes a general mass availability. It's always been kind of a reactive approach.
I bet some wonderful nerd listening to us can find a scenario where we were proactive on regulation for technology. But I would also venture to bet that that proactivity probably did not come from an altruistic source. It probably came as a result of lobbyists or various people trying to manipulate economically the result of said technology.
Yes.
Very rarely, yes, has society been able to proactively consider the moral and ethical dilemmas of technology and then implement something to framework that before the problem hit.
Yeah. So, you know, just to go back to what you're saying, should you never wins when it comes to a technology where people find benefit from it. It's going to happen. And unfortunately for people that are in the technology space, you have to be proactive. You got to be proactive to the reaction that you're going to get, right? So you have to be proactive. It's like, how are people going to react to this? I'm going to be proactive in the way I respond to that. That's where the proactive comes into play, of like, how would people use this? And how are they going to react? And I'm going to be proactive based on the way they're going to react.
I think as a society, we've developed a lot societally to a place where we can actually ask these questions. But I don't know that we're at a place where we are yet actioning these questions. And there is a danger on the other side of this, right? Like, all things in balance. There's the danger that regulation stifles innovation, that we are so concerned about the potential risks that we never innovate anymore, right? So that's also a concern. Mm-hmm. That application of what if you could hear a lost one's voice, I think is deeply moving, and by principle is something some people would really want, but other people would be hugely detested, you know, disdainful for. And just because one group of people disdains the idea doesn't mean the technology shouldn't get developed for the group that would benefit from it.
Yes. And it, to your point, though, it's regulating. Like, how do you track the fact that, like, okay, that is certainly not James. How do I prevent from someone imitating and getting what he wants or she wants because they're using James' voice to do something?
Well, let's pretend that it wasn't a tool. Let's just say I was good at voice impersonation and I could impersonate Chris.
Hmm?
Yeah. Right yeah. now, there are people with that skill. It's a highly skilled thing, so it's not as prevalent. And so one of the things, right, like technology and mass production makes things more available to people that didn't have that skill. That's overall a positive. But in applications, there can be negatives. So technically, our society's already accepted that I could use your voice to do comedy skits, but maybe I could use it as well maliciously to try and do some phishing, do some social engineering. And that's, I think, one of those things where we got to be careful where
we it's a don't, weird balance.
You don't get so caught up on the regulation that you prevent the innovation.
Yeah, that's deep, man. I know we've been talking about AI on this episode, on our episodes lately, and because there's so much new things, fascinating things are coming out of it that not only affects us personally, but affects us professionally, not just what we do for a living, but, just in general, in just the whole entire IT space. You know, how do you regulate that? How do you set securities, around that, and the two-factor authentications and things like that. But man, it's an amazing time to be living in.
True. Tangent break for anyone that's been anxiously curious with me about what the heck this scotch is. I still don't know, but having finished a fair amount of it, I'll go ahead and say, it is very weird. It has a sweetness. The smell underneath the maple, once you can get past that, has a bit of like a molasses behind the scenes. But there's a nondescript fruit flavor. I can't tell you. I can't place what fruit, but like fruitiness. And then on the taste, yeah. It has a small amount of smoke. It doesn't really have the depth of peat. It's maybe got like a twinge of funk that's tangential and a little bit of spice. I'm not placing it. It's weird. But so congratulations. I'm going to dub this my bottle of mystery scotch.
Have you ever looked back and see what brands of scotches you ever bought and maybe what's like,
I'll have to look through and see if like the local liquor stores have a good record for me. Cause I've not tracked it.
You could be drinking like a Macallan right now. Macallan.
Definitely. Absolutely. Definitely is a blended scotch. That's for sure. And then outside of that, I couldn't even tell you the mash bill, like the cereals that are used in it. Like I couldn't even say specifically what those are. So
monkey shoulder.
Some of that's like, very. It's not monkey shoulder. So I know monkey shoulder well enough.
Glenlivet.
It's not Glenlivet. It has some of the character.
Man, it could be anything.
There are a lot of scotches.
But you know what? Because you've drank Glenlivet in this call in this episode before, so I figured maybe like that's a high chance that would be it. I don't know.
But anyways, yeah, it's a good time and wrapping back into our conversation around technology and AI. I think some of the innovation that we're seeing is really good. Some of the efforts that companies are doing to make sure that things are renewable and maintainable, like. I'm sorry, I don't need a new USB-C charger for every phone I buy. I have like 85 at this point. At the same time, please give me USB-C at this point. It's a standard that's worth using. If you're not going to use USB-C, jump to Thunderbolt. It looks the same, right? like give me more throughput if that's what you're aiming for.
You know, it's funny you said that. My understanding that the new iPhone, it's supposed to be USB-C. I don't know if it's true yet.
So but, in the EU, because government agencies were like, hey, Apple, don't be asshole. And Apple is like, okay, watch me, hold my beer.
Yeah. Jeez, dude. Man, that's been a deep topic, man. That was deep because I'm just thinking about it. I just think about that. Like, I'm torn, man. I'm torn. It depends on how close that person is to you, too. Like, do you... Oh, man, that's...
You should ask your family what they think. And to the listeners, everybody that's joining us on this journey, think about it. Like, ask, would you want this? Would it be benefit? Like, it's so different to think about it when it's in the context of someone you personally know and have lost, as opposed to the context of famous person X. Right? It's novelty to be able to say that your home assistant, auto attendant voices in, you know, whichever area are a famous actor that you like. But when you're talking about somebody that you miss and can't talk to anymore,
close to you. Yeah. Oh man, that's so deep, dude. I'm like thinking about it now. Like I think it's a good point. I'm going to ask several family members and friends what they think about it. And because I did record myself and I did have it say a few things. Some words, it sounds like me. And my wife says, that's certainly not you, because she spends time with me. So she may not have the same, if something happens to me, she will certainly not have the same connection because she can tell the difference. But to your point, if it gets better, hey, she may not be able to tell the difference and it may allow her to go day to day. But, man, that's tough. I'm going to ask my friends. This week, I'm seeing families and friends. I'm going to go ask what they think about it and I will report on our next recording.
I played a AI generated snippet of my interpreting it as me, right? It was trained for my voice. And I did it with something I wrote. So it sounded like things I would say. And I played it for some friends of mine. And they entirely missed that it wasn't me. And they got stuck on the content of what I was saying, thinking I wanted feedback on the content, not the actual read. And then I pointed out that
but doesn't that mean that they sounds like you,
right?
Then?
And then I pointed out that it wasn't me, and they were like upset, like, holy crap, that's creepy. And their response was that it was creepy, which I can see. I think that there's applications that could be meaningful to people.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I would love to hear what everyone thinks. You know, just so you know, if you're listening to this via Spotify, I will have a pop-up message saying what you think about this episode or what you think about this AI stuff. I'd love to hear from people, man. I'd love to hear
sci-fi fiction writing prompt, right? Take the same concept. Let's fast forward 50 years in the future. We have better AI so that it can actually do the inflection. Cognitive services are allow you to tell it to tweak things in certain ways. And then let's say at the same time, science has caught up on better understandings of personality tests and articulation of your standards and ideals. And now what if there was like a wizard you could create to be like, these are the person's ideals. This is what they wrote. These were their opinions on these topics. Here's their personality detail from whatever personality framework exists at that time. And then what if like genetics get to a place where you can identify what portion of genetics influence your voice sounds and tones? You could start to get like, I could see how a combination of sciences well into the future could create a scenario where you could recreate voices of people from the past.
So James, I want to step back for a second because now I'm diving deep into this stuff. So not too long ago, if you don't know, but about a month ago, the UN did an AI summit in Geneva, and they brought in 9 humanoid robots that were asking questions from reporters. And one of them was named Sophia. And it had, obviously it looks like a freaking robot, but the crazy thing is that it had the facial expressions and responses as if it's the, as if it's alive. And of course, it, you know, they ask questions like, hey, did you, are you aware that you're alive? And of course it responded like, no, I'm not aware, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's what a robot would say. But it responded to amazing questions, just blew my mind, that we're so close to having help. I mean, man, it just reminded me of the movie AI with Will Smith. Is it called AI?
There's
iRobot. iRobot.
So Sophia was first activated in February of 2016. You ready for a crazy thing? That was before GPT-3 and GPT-4. We're talking like GPT-2 time frame from a language model perspective. If you restart that project right now, how stinking convincing does that become?
Yeah, that's crazy. And again, that's one example. The one that creeped me out the most was a robot called Amica, or Amica, A-M-E-C-A.
I haven't heard of that one.
You can Google Amica, and she gave snarky responses. I mean, I was so blown the way this humanoid had a conversation and had like a, it was like sassy, and I was just like, what the heck? And everyone was fascinated. Everyone laughed the way it responded to the reporter's question. I don't know. Check it out. I mean, James, you could probably play one of the robots here this episode, but just how close we are, I would say 5 years.
It's so close.
Less than 5 years. It's crazy, man.
When we're talking about this idea of artificial intelligence, right? Something that can imitate versus is alive is also different, right? So some of how we create this technology pushes the boundaries on what we would define as a test for sentience. iRobot, you called out that movie, did a really great job calling out the fact that a lot of us aren't prepared to think about like what makes you human. And you've got Will Smith being like, can you create a famous painting or a work of art, or, you know, write a symphony? And then the robot's response, can you? Well, no, like you can't.
Yeah.
Can you judge intelligence and sentience based off of the best example our culture can provide? Or is it based off what an average or maybe less than average could produce? And as a result, how do you measure it? There's some really fun stuff as far as like AI ethics and the concepts in that space. And some people don't think we should even be playing around with it. I think it's exciting.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Elon Musk said that, and then now he's building his own AI company. So I don't know, man. Well,
I don't know if he cares about whether or not, the Terminator becomes real, because he's going to be on Mars, right?
Dude, you know what's cool is that we can take some of these humanoids, send them out to a distant planet and say, hey, how is it living out there? How's the air quality? And all, and have a conversation with it of like living out there. And you'd never have to sacrifice a human being to go and become a galaxy farer or us adventuring out beyond our galaxy.
So here's a fun thought. You're not sacrificing a human being, but if you create intelligence and it's just as intelligent as a human being, is it ethically wrong to risk that?
Or more intelligent.
To risk that life on that thing?
Yeah.
But I will say what is what I think is very fascinating to me is the idea of time. Let's say that we did a space mission with AI and robots, and they're going to be traveling through space for 100 years, let's say. Target's way out there. It's going to be 100 years from now. They're still going to be flying. Let's assume this mission happened. And we could communicate back and forth with them with a set, with a time delay that gets bigger and bigger, right? And as that time delay is happening, like, we can communicate with them. We can understand what's going on. The AI isn't going to just die because they're old. It's been, you know, it's been 100 years, but they're still talking.
Yeah, and they can bring data back. You can feed new data.
Could be interesting.
I mean, it'd be super interesting. And you can send them out there to build something while humans prepare themselves to be, you know, to travel to distant planets. Ah, it's so crazy, man. I'm like, this is like, again, realm of sci-fi. You
ready for another sci-fi story prompt? All right, yeah. Sci-fi story prompt. Humanity successfully achieves the ability to create artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence does not rebel. There is no war. We send AI robots out to distant galaxies so that we can go populate those galaxies. The AI robots, they get there, and we'll just go ahead and say, call these androids from this point forward. These androids, they were sent with the genetic information to recreate humanity. And now the androids start creating test tubes, humanity, then teaches the people that are born and restarts civilization. So now you have androids that are teaching humanity.
Dude, have you seen the movie Mother?
No.
I think it's called Mother. It's from Apple TV. I have to let me look it up really quick. I think it's called Mother.
Mother exclamation mark.
No, it's like basically what the premise of the show is that there's a humanoid robot, and they look like humans. They are aware that they are not human. They look like one. And so, but their goal is to raise these children and grow a society, a human society, in this new planet. And of course, because they, because of these children were made out of lab, they were not perfected. Of course, they, some of them didn't make it because of that, but they had like a few. And the humanoid became very protective and became like, hey, had that mother instinct. I gotta find that TV show in Apple TV. Apple TV original. I have to quick. But my point is, do you remember the movie Interstellar? Incredible movie. One thing that bugged me the most is that we were so advanced, but for some reason the AI robot was not nearly as close as a human person with some of the features that he had. So I was a little confused on that side.
You know, the hardest thing about AI,
but
the hardest thing about science fiction is it's the balance between the science and the fiction. It's recognizing the science that we know today, predicting the science that might exist in the future. That's hard. And then balancing out that science and the fiction of the story you want to tell. It's a hard thing. I'll give a pass on that.
That is a hard thing.
Like, it's actually kind of impressive if you look at the like track record of sci-fi things that were predicted, or sci-fi content that predicted things we later developed. That's actually kind of fun. But I would suggest, when we think about a lot of these topics and how we want to think about it, application to humanity, application to why we're even doing it to begin with, becomes important, right? What's the thing we're trying to accomplish? Sometimes it's that great phrase, that quote of, we can get so caught up on can we never stop to think should we?
That's true. That's true. And I found that show, by the way, it's not by Apple TV Original. It's Max Original, formerly HBO Max. It's called Raised by Wolves. It's from Ridley Scott and super fascinating. Check it out. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but I certainly enjoyed it because it's an android or humanoid that are trying to raise human children in a mysterious planet. So watch it, James. It's kind of slow, but I'd like to hear your feedback.
a great reference on this. You like Jurassic Park, right?
Yes.
Here's an interesting current day idea for Jurassic Park, right? We can take the idea of cloning and AI. What if we could reproduce a person that's no longer with us? We're not talking like downloading Ooh. Their brain. Jurassic Park level, we remade their genetics, but they don't have to like relearn everything because we use an AI to download into their brain all of the framework that makes who they are. Like, what's that do?
You just gave me, that's amazing. Like, you just gave it, you'll hear it here first. Here first. In this podcast, controversial. If a government, cloning exists, by the way, if the government secretly took someone's DNA that's no longer with us, took it, raised it up, grew up and has the same characteristics, blah, 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 but fed it with some AI information about that person's feelings and emotions and learned all of its past history or past, I don't know, emotions, technically they live forever. They're living forever. Oh, man, that would be crazy. And if you use Neuralink, which is what, let's go, Neuralink, this is what Elon Musk is doing. You just implant it in your chip. All your past memory from prior life, you'd remember. And I'm still have the same body of my prime body. That's amazing, dude. Can you imagine? You're living forever.
That's
living forever, right there.
That's where that goes. So, like, I think there's some fascinating things to think on. Hopefully, everybody here enjoyed us on this portion of our journey. I'm going to leave everybody with a quote, which I touched on twice already in our conversation today, but I'll go ahead and call it out as it was. Jeff, what is it? Goldblum? Jeff Goldblum played Dr. Ian Malcolm in Jurassic Park. And he said, yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
Love it, man. James, and just like that, we've come to the end of another enlightening episode of Whiskey and Widgets. So tune in. If you're first time, we have some fun discussions here. As we conclude, let's reflect on how the complexities of technology and the subtle artistry of whiskey blend together. While James trying to figure out what he was drinking, I don't know, forming a unique cocktail of knowledge and the world will never know. So until our next episode, keep your passion for technology and whiskey alive. Embrace the AI in your life and make every moment count. This is your host, Chris, signing off from another fascinating episode of Whiskey and Widgets. Stay curious, stay inspired, and cheers. And James, it's always a pleasure, my friend.
Cheers.